Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's me, Len Testa, and this is our show for the week of Schmurz Day, June 14th, 2021. On the show today, news, listener questions, and in our main segment, Jim gives us the history of the Toy Story Mania attraction. Let's get started by bringing in the man who says that when you think about it, the seashore is the worst possible place to sell seashells. It's Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
For some odd reason, this makes me think of that wonderful Stephen Wright joke. I have a hobby. I have the world's largest collection of seashells. I keep it scattered on beaches around the world. Maybe you've seen some of it.
Is he still alive?
He is. He is. And he's still, he has honestly done some of my favorite stand-up. I mean, for example, the companion joke for this is, you can't have everything. Where would you put it?
My favorite is everything's walking distance if you have the time.
Well, speaking of time, one more Stephen Wright joke. I went to a restaurant that serves breakfast at any time, so I ordered French toast during the Renaissance.
Yeah.
Okay, tip your waitresses,
folks.
We could do an entire show
on this.
All right. There we go.
All right, Jim, let's do a quick shout-out to subscribers over at disneydish.bandcamp.com. Thanks to new subscribers Sarah Leo, Four Dreams and Ideas, Jay Bean, and Max Slabaugh, and longtime subscribers Ingaloo80, Lee Stone, Karen Meadows, and Move E. Buff. Jim, these were the early designers on Epcot's original test track, whose idea for the world's first in-ride drive-through restaurant still remains in the Disney archives, waiting for the day when someone in management knows the future when they see it. True story.
Seriously, that's actually a genius idea. Someone at Disney needs to send you a check now. Because if you had the option of hitting that button on the test track vehicle to just slide over to, well, if it's Disney Quick Service, it would only take 40 minutes.
You're thinking of Disneyland, Jim.
Oh, I'm sorry. But no, that's a genius idea right there.
I think in terms of a comedy routine, I think it'd just be hysterical.
There you go.
Can I even look at you? Oh, and then it's gone. Anyway. All right, Jim, before we do the yep. news, I went to Epcot this past week. My sister Christina had set up an agave experience at La Cava del Tequila, so I'll tell you about it. So Hilda Castillo, who we all know is the tequila ambassador, one of the tequila ambassadors at La Cava, hosted it. I love Hilda. She recently earned the title of Conocedor de Tequila, which is one step below sommelier. So congratulations to her. So just before we get started on this review, everyone knows I love La Cava, and I'm absolutely not going to do an unbiased review of it. This is going to be a love fest for the next 5 minutes. So the thing that I love about Hilda, and I've done tequila tastings with her for many years, is every time she does a tasting, I learn something new about tequila. In this case, though, I learned about something new about Hilda herself. So Hilda said that, we asked her the question, like, how did you get involved with tequila? And she said that when she was 16, she went to her family and she said, look, I was very traditional Mexican family. Hilda's from the town of Tequila in Jalisco, Mexico. So she was literally born with tequila in her blood. She went to her family and said, look, I am not cut out for, marriage, family, and that. I want to go to school and get a job. And they said, well, that's fine. Go get a job. Where does Hilda go get her first job when she's 16, Jim? Jose Cuervo. That's right. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
So Hilda has been working tequila her entire life. And so I asked her, well, how did you end up at Disney? And she said she had worked for Cuervo for a number of years, going to school and everything. And they came to her one day and said, we have these VIPs from America who want a tour of not only the factory, but of the process and the tasting. And so she gave them the tour. At the end of it, it was, and I'm not going to mention anybody's names because they're executives at Disney who are still there. They were there. They said, look, it's Wednesday. We have a job opening. We have a visa ready for you. The job starts on Monday in the United States. And she went home and told her parents. And her parents were like, are you crazy? And she's like, I have a plane ticket. Maybe I am, And she's been doing that ever since. Anyway, I just got back from Las Vegas over the weekend. Jimmy and I talked about it before the show, where I took two 23-year-olds for a birthday. And so I figured the tequila experience was just a continuation of the weekend. So the tequila experience starts with this. Number one is vodka as a palate cleanser, sort of get all the tastes out of your mouth. And then there are four tequilas, a Blanco, which is unaged, straight from the still, Reposado, which is aged up to a year, an Añejo, which is 1 to 3 years, and then an extra Añejo, which is above 3 years. So four shots of tequila, then a Mezcal, which gets its smoky flavor from the way the piñas are cooked in the pits to extract the juices. And then you finish with a margarita to go. And when they say to go, I think they mean to go to the Betty Ford Clinic. Because, like, first of all, it was all fabulous. All of the tequilas were excellent. But the thing that they've added to this is they've given you a small plate with things like chocolate or lime or lemon or cocoa or coffee beans on it. So you can see what sort of flavors you get from the individual tequilas. So, you know, if you think this particular thing smells of chocolate or honey or cinnamon or whatever, you've got that right next to you. So you can sort of like smell one, then smell the other, right? Compare the scents. And that was amazing because that really, really helped sort of identify what it is that you're getting from each of these. And then Hilda has this technique where you smell the tequila in three different places around the glass. And it's she's just fantastic at it. It was really good. Anyway, super fun. I think it's $150 per person. It literally should be either the first or the last thing you do during the day because you're not going to want to do much else after that. I think they're running them during Food and Wine. Okay. It's a fantastic, fantastic event. So,
and you were, in fact, able to close your fist to hold a margarita to go.
You know, they actually give it to you in a larger thing, and I think it's just for that. I Ubered there and back, thank God. Mm-hmm. And I would also suggest that people Uber or, you know, ideally you get a room at like Beach Club and just stagger over there. Yeah. But super fun. If you guys get a chance to do it during Food and Wine, the Agave Experience at La Cava, it always sells out. So look for it to be announced when it happens. Mm-hmm. All right, Jim, let's do the news. Folks, the Disney Dish News is brought to you by Storybook Destinations, trusted travel partner of the Disney Dish Podcast. For a worry-free travel experience every time, book online at storybookdestinations.com. All right, Jim, some reopenings. The indoor play area at Dumbo reopened yesterday. It was at the Magic Kingdom Tuesday night. What is Thursday? So it was their Tuesday night, and they were getting ready to open, and I believe it opened up on Wednesday. Also, the post-ride game at Mission Space apparently has also opened up as well, so that's good.
Did I hear correctly that Dumbo, at the least, it's even in the indoor play area, it's 70% capacity? Is that what you heard as well?
I couldn't tell whether it was reduced, because we had somebody there looking. I couldn't tell whether it was reduced capacity or parents just weren't sending their kids in there, like, because kids aren't vaccinated yet, right?
Yeah.
And so I couldn't tell whether it was like we're limiting the number of people or the parents were just self-limiting themselves. Mm-hmm. The other thing is Ohana at the Polynesian reopens July 9th. I got up at 5 o'clock this morning and got reservations for both breakfast and dinner. So the following description comes from our friends over at WW Magic. For breakfast, start with pineapple coconut breakfast bread, Stitch and Mickey Mouse waffles, and then egg skillets with ham, sausage, and breakfast potatoes. So the standard sort of Disney breakfast stuff. No characters, and I think the price is down to like $25, which, as far as Disney breakfasts go, I think that's pretty good. Dinner is all you can eat platters of steak, chicken, sausage, and island shrimp casserole with fried rice and roasted broccolini. Pot stickers, crispy soy chicken wings, those are all from the old menu. And the signature Ohana bread pudding with warm caramel sauce and vanilla ice cream are also back. So in the old menu had peel and eat shrimp. That is now shrimp casserole. I don't think there's a green salad, and there used to be. And then noodles have been replaced by rice. And I think the noodle thing has caused the biggest controversy online.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. The reaction for, like, no noodles.
You were mentioning having been to Vegas and the crab leg shortage out in the real populace versus the casinos.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you don't have to worry about people stealing casino chips in Vegas now. It's people are stealing crab legs. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Given we are talking about noodles versus rice, so it's like, this can't be a cost per unit thing, because it's like, what, a 0.005?
Exactly. Yeah, the two, one is the cheapest grain, the other one is the cheapest carb you could possibly make. I think it has to do with staffing, because noodles don't sit well, right? You have to, noodles have to be fresh, otherwise they clump together, or you put oil on them, and then they tend to soften over time, right? So noodles require constant upkeep, whereas rice doesn't. And that constant upkeep means you have to have someone in the kitchen who's on noodle duty. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they have the kitchen staff. And that's going to lead into one of our next segments there. But I think it's entirely staffing. That's why there's not why there's rice instead of noodles. It might be slightly cheaper, but yeah, that's not the driving thing there.
Okay.
So I've got breakfast and dinner reservations on the 9th. Assuming I have enough Pepto-Bismol, I will report on it on the 10th. And I think the 10th is actually, it'll be the following week after that, because we'll record on the 8th.
Okay.
Tangerine Cafe at Epcot reopens July 15th. Similar menu as before. This was one of the highest rated restaurants in Epcot prior to closing, so that's super good news. The big change here, of course, is Disney's running it now instead of a third-party group, so we'll see what happens there.
Yeah.
Also, Jim, I know we keep saying it, and eventually it's going to be true. It looks like Space 220 is going to reopen, or going to open.
Well, this time, at least we can speak with some confidence, because there's actually Jobbricks out there,
yep.
You know, for very specific positions, yeah. Or so says the Patina Group.
The Patina Group is hiring, so look for that in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
We say that, Jim, and this has got to be the most star-crossed restaurant opening. Like, I think this is one of those things where even if I get a media invite, I probably won't go, because, you know, I'd be looking out for asteroids or meteors. like literally from outer space. Like, what's gonna happen? I'd be so jumpy, I wouldn't be able to enjoy it. You know, like,
this is Central Florida we're talking about. Think sinkhole length.
Sinkhole, exactly. every time there was a slight vibration, I'd be like, here it comes. Oh well.
Yeah.
We had a good run. Yeah. So hopefully in the fall that reopens. I'm looking forward to seeing it. If nothing else, I mean, other than the fact that it's gonna finally open, some of that technology might be things we see in the Star Wars hotel as well. So,
oh, no doubt.
Might be a quick hint of that. Finally, in terms of reopenings, Sebastian's Bistro at Caribbean Beach reopens June 24th. This was a below average restaurant before the pandemic. And, you know, with staff shortages and things like that, I didn't book a meal here right away. I kind of like wanted to see what happens and see some initial reviews from other people first. Before I do it, this is one of those cases where, you know, normally when I review a restaurant, opening night is fair game, because as I tell people all the time, Disney picked the day on which it's opening, right? It's not a surprise to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
They're a $75 billion company. They certainly have the means to practice as much as they want on cooking the dishes. There's really no excuse, especially if you're charging full price, an opening day review is fair game, right? In this case, because it wasn't very highly rated before, and because it's it's one of the few sit downs at a lower priced hotel, right? This is an artist point we're talking about here. I'm going to give that kitchen team a little bit of time to get up to speed to see what happens there.
Okay. Especially given the current job market in Orlando.
Yeah. It's super, super tough.
That seems fair.
Yeah. So I want to do a side Las Vegas. So I'm in the cab in Las Vegas going from the airport to my hotel and talking to the cab driver. And the cab driver actually mentioned, like, do you know anyone who can work in a kitchen? Because the Rio is giving out like a $500 bonus to anyone who can work in a kitchen. I'm like, wow. Lady, I just flew in from out of town. I can't work here. She's like, yeah, but if you know someone. Okay.
If you'd like to step into the kitchen, you know, if you're done gambling for a while. Exactly.
We're just gonna stop by this one off strip place where the owner just wants to talk to you for 5 minutes. You may want to see what you can do with a skillet. Who knows?
Thanks.
Anyway. All right. So, Jim, the big news out of Epcot, and I think for wider Walt Disney World, Harmonious testing continues with more fireworks.
Yes. Yes.
And there's a rumor going around that we may sometime in July see the return of some normal fireworks. Like, I don't think we're going to see 4th of July spectacular fireworks. And the main reason for that is the supply chain involved in getting those fireworks to the United States is probably months long out of China. And you would have had to have known, like, in January that you were going to host fireworks in July. And I don't think Disney knew that in January.
Especially if people are looking for the sort of classic 4th of July perimeter display.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. Yeah. I mean, if we got regular Happily Ever After and we got whatever they ordered for Harmonious or whatever's at the end, was at the end of, they might have had leftover stuff from Epcot Forever.
Mm-hmm.
I would be thrilled with that, right? Okay. They probably have stuff on storage or a normal order for Happily Ever After. Yeah, that'd be fine. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, at this point, I would be very surprised if we did not see fireworks in July. That's just my prediction. Haven't heard anything yet. We'll see what happens.
Okay.
And then finally, Jim, I was at Epcot yesterday, and I noticed an opening procedure change. Now, normally, and this is only at Epcot, by the way, I confirmed today, normally, the you know, if a park says it has an official opening at 9 a.m., it's really open at 8:10, right? 8:10, 8:15, right? 45 to 50 minutes in advance. And you can go on in any of the rides that are open. You know, you can go on. Like they don't hold you in a central area. There's no like old school rope drop. Like once they decide to let you into the park, you're in the park and you can go about your business. But at Epcot, I think on Monday, they started this process where they let you in past the tap stiles, but then you're held before Spaceship Earth in that, you know, Future World Plaza until exactly 10:30. And then at 10:30, everyone is free to go. And so so there's no social distancing, you know, anymore outdoors. But my first question on this is why? Why would you do it? Now, number one, if you start the rides at 10:30 versus 10:10, let's say for Epcot, you save, you know, 20 minutes of Labor Day, probably half an hour of Labor Day, you know, getting the rides up. But I think, Jim, this, remember, 30 minutes in advance is what we're getting later on in the fall with early theme park entry.
Oh, you're right.
So my suspicion is this is a test of two things. One, how they're going to hold people for early theme park entry, right? And then number two, think about the crowd buildup that happens in a park starting 45 or 50 minutes before the park officially opens. When I was in Future World Plaza, there were several thousand people basically going on three rides, right? So the thing that Disney's trying to figure out now, especially when you talk about, you know, long-term things like Genie, what is the effect on standby lines when you hold thousands of people in a corral and then release them to three rides immediately? Right. What happens to the wait times? And I'll tell you what happened, right? So the wait time at Soarin' went from basically zero, if you were at the front of the line, to 45 minutes if you were at the end of that group in the span of like 3 minutes because of the many thousands of people who went into or who were in the park, you know, almost half of them went to Soarin'. A large chunk went to Test Track. Frozen was actually broken down. Didn't open during the day. So nobody went to World Showcase. And, you know, a few people went to Spaceship Earth or whatever. But the vast majority of people are going to Test Track or to Soarin'. So the wait times there, instead of sort of growing more gradually as if the park opened at 10, it basically went from 0 to 45 in the span of a few minutes. And there was actually at one point, as soon as the park opened, there was a line from the entrance of Soarin' all the way back to Living with the Land. And at that point, Disney had stopped people from going down the stairs. You know how like it's a two levels at the Land Pavilion. They'd stop people from going down the stairs of the escalator because they didn't want people running into each other at the bottom of the stairs. So they'd actually capped the line, and the line started winding back towards the Awesome Planet film. And then when it reached the entrance of the Land Pavilion, they stopped letting people in the entrance, and the line went down the ramp towards, you know, the middle of Future World West. And this was a relatively uncrowded day. I mean, it's a Monday. And granted, it was it's a Monday. It's the first full week of summer vacation. So the crowds were substantial, but it wasn't spring break or it wasn't Christmas. And my first thought was, if this is just the initial group at 10:30 on some random Monday in June, what would the line look like at Thanksgiving or Christmas? Or like where would you put the people? You have the same problem, right? Like, and so the thing that Disney was doing where they were opening up the park at, you know, 10:10 or whatever, that basically allowed the first wave of people to get in and out of Soarin', right? Because between 10:10 and 10:30, that's 20 minutes. That's roughly 500 or 600 people going through Soarin', you know, current capacity or whatever. And that's 500 or 600 people who aren't in that line. But now they're all in that line. Right. And so that's what that does. So that's super interesting. It's the only park that's doing it so far. So I want to see what happens at other parks. We went over to Animal Kingdom today. Did you see what happened at Animal Kingdom today with the power outage?
Yes, yes. What was so funny is if you were on Twitter at that time, the people who were doing the Jurassic Park jokes, you know, the gates are down, the gates are down.
Exactly. Like, yeah. So it didn't happen at Animal Kingdom today. It didn't happen at Magic Kingdom. I'll check the studios tomorrow when I head over there. But yeah, anyway.
Hearing all of this about Soaring is fascinating. And remember, you know, Soaring is the attraction that added a third theater, you know, for capacity. Let's jump ahead to late 2022, early 2023, when Cosmic Rewind comes online. And the notion that
we'll have both Remy and Cosmic Rewind
online. Yeah. Yeah, but if the World Showcase plan holds, where there's that slight delay between Future World and World Showcase when those open, the center of gravity of Future World, at least in the morning, will shift so radically from everybody goes right to go to Soarin' to everybody goes left to Cosmic and Rewind. And remember that, you know, it's always that first year when, you know, the money is spent on the attraction itself rather than shade structures.
This is one of those things. It's the let's design this ride in California, but build it in Florida effect. Yeah. That's definitely true. And what we're going to see shortly here on October 1st is we're going to see the center of gravity shift at Epcot from Future World to France in World Showcase.
That is an excellent point.
And the entrances for International Gateway will become much more crowded because that's where the smart people will go to get into France, because it's a 10-minute head start over Future World. But then as soon as Cosmic Rewind opens, it all shifts back except for, you know, small number of families who are still going to go on Remy and maybe Frozen and stuff like that. But the other interesting thing about that is when you consider, you know, we've talked about what Disney wants to do with Genie, where, you know, they want to plan out your entire day, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that the people who are working in that have to consider is there's going to be a non-zero number of people who sign up for Genie and completely disregard whatever that app tells them to do first, and they just go to Cosmic Rewind, right? They're like, we'll figure out the app later on. And that is going to completely throw off the rest of the day, because now you've got a large number of people who have done one ride, and you can't send them there later on. And now there's a limited number of rides that you can send them to. It's going to – I don't know how Disney's going to get around that one. That's going to be super interesting.
No, absolutely. On the other hand, you got to feel badly for the crew at La Cava, for all of the Disney employees. We'll show up there at the end of the day and just bring me a flight of tequila. All right, I've been dealing with crowds all day. Just keep them coming.
Exactly. Archie, let's do some listener questions. This one from Greg, DVC Dad on Twitter, who sent in a screen cap that he got, and it said this: I purchased tickets to a special event like Disney's After Hours Boobash or Mickey's Very Merry Christmas Party, and selected print at home e-tickets as a delivery method, but I never got the tickets. Who should I contact? And the reason why Greg sent it to us is it explicitly mentions both Boobash and Mickey's Very Merry Christmas Party. So, good catch. There's a couple of ways to read this. One is they just simply replaced Halloween Party with Boobash, right? And just updated it. But I think given the fact that Boobash exists, is a virtual guarantee that we're going to see a Christmas party as well. Whether it's called the same thing, I'm not sure. But I would peg the odds of us seeing a Christmas celebration at pretty darn close to 100%. What do you think, Jim?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, just this week, there was word coming out of California that the decorations team for that resort, it's like, we are prepping a Halloween program, and we are prepping our Christmas program. So, on both coasts, leaning heavily into the holidays to get folks back.
Yeah,
so.
And I would expect it to be some sort of after-hours event as well, not the it may retain the name. I think the name is sort of iconic for the Christmas party. I can't imagine them change it to be like Disney After Hours.
Non-denominational
holiday celebration.
There we go.
Winter celebration, yeah. Actually, you can't even say winter, because if you're coming from Australia, it's summer. Oh, so you don't want to be a hemispherist, right?
Okay, contact the Seinfeld people. Find out what it's going to cost to get Festivus.
Fair enough. All right, our friend Chris Lawson sent in a Disney survey. We've seen the questions before. It's sort of standard. What made you plan this? But his answer to one question just cracked me up. So I want to read this one out. So the question number 20 was: which of these factors would you say is influence on you being somewhat committed to your current Walt Disney World reservation? And it's things like quarantine requirements, pace of new coronavirus infections in Central Florida, my job or work situation or schedule, new school learning environments, and so on. And Chris's answer was, in reality, as a family of nine, I can't afford anything else besides Fort Wilderness. Let's be honest. I made a resort reservation because of the perks, early fast pass reservations and getting into the parks early that come with staying on site. If those perks don't come back by December, I'm dropping my reservation. So Chris gets to the nub of the point.
Oh, hey, okay. Speak truth to power. Okay, cool. I thank you. Exactly. Thank you for doing that.
All right, this one's from Kelso from T-Town, who sent in actually an interesting question. He said, we're going this summer as a makeup trip that was canceled during due to COVID. I want to surprise my family, a wife and two girls, ages 12 and 10, with a progressive dinner. I researched and found this used to be offered by Disney, but honestly, I feel I could put one together for less money and it would be just as fun. So I'll pause here for a second. So progressive dinner is where you start at one hotel and you work your way around course by course to other restaurants. And the way that Disney did it was Magic Kingdom Resorts. So starting off at the Poly, ending up at the Grand Floridian. Or sorry, starting off at the Contemporary, ending up at the Grand Floridian. So Kelso writes, we always plan an off day in the middle of our vacation. If you were to plan a progressive dinner, appetizers, dinner, dessert, where would you go and why? You and Jim always have great knowledge on these types of things. I would do this at restaurants not located in the parks. Time wouldn't be a factor since it's our off day and we can use the afternoon and night. All right, so a couple of things. I'm going with restaurants that are going to be open next month because Kelso said that he's going next month. And I'm not going to do the Contemporary Poly Grand Flow Loop because Disney did that already. So have to be something different. So the thing I was looking for here was, where do you start and then where do you end up? And we just mentioned that fireworks might be coming back. So I wanted to end up somewhere where Kelso had the potential to maybe see fireworks if they were coming back. Okay, so I thought of California Grill to start off at appetizers, but two things made me not go with it. Number one, nobody wants to get that dressed up for appetizers, especially if we're going from resort to resort in the summer, right? And number two, it's already been done. So I went with Geyser Point at Wilderness Lodge. Great resort, very pretty, great restaurant. The other thing I was looking at here is I'd already picked out my entrees at this point, and I didn't want I wanted stuff that was flavorful, but not like super, super, super bold, because you don't want to start off bold and basically desensitize your tongue to the experiences that you're going to have later. So I specifically also picked appetizers here that were different than what we're going to get later on. So I started with the shrimp on a wire, which is served chilled with soy lime vinaigrette, togarishi, which is Japanese seasoning, shishito peppers, which I like, and then chili aioli. Now, that might sound spicy. It's not. I've had it. It's delicious. Okay. The other thing I would suggest for the kids, there's a cheese and charcuterie board that serves two relatively mild, great cheeses, all from the Pacific Northwest. Again, not going to overwhelm your taste buds. And then the other thing I would recommend is the crispy salmon croquettes with a miso tartar sauce. It's twice we've mentioned tartar sauce in this show. But again, very subtle flavors, nothing that's going to overwhelm your taste buds for the next thing. The other thing is that you can... I would Uber from Wilderness Lodge. You could also take the boat from Wilderness Lodge to the Magic Kingdom and then boat to where we're going next, which is the Grand Floridian Cafe. So you've got a couple of different transportation options there. It also gives you some time to sort of digest as you're going to your next thing.
Excellent idea.
So for entrees, I would do Grand Floridian Cafe, which I ate at again on Tuesday. I love the buttermilk fried chicken there. I think that's fantastic. I also sampled... Yeah, go ahead.
And you previously talked about the buttermilk fried chicken.
It's amazing.
But what are the point? It seats six, doesn't it?
I mean, I could not finish it on Tuesday. And I, to that point on Tuesday, because I knew where I was going there and I knew, you know, the size of the portions that they give you. To that point in that day, my meals consisted of a hard boiled egg. Like I went in hungry, didn't have any appetizers, didn't have any bread. I'm like, you know what? I've never finished this thing, and I got pretty close, but I absolutely did not finish it.
Wow, that's still amazing.
And it was delicious. Okay. Buttermilk fried chicken. Also, I tried the New York strip, which was great. I would recommend that medium rare. If you wanted to try a seafood, the miso glazed salmon, but we just had salmon croquettes as appetizers. Yeah, so, you know, balance that out. If you're going to pick one, then don't do the other. Okay. Also, they've got an Impossible Burger there. I didn't try it this time, but I've had it before. It looks great. They also do gluten-free there as well, so you can do that. And then I would walk over to the Poly for dessert. And here I would get, for the kids, Dole Whips from Pineapple and I, and then tropical drinks from either Tambu Lounge, which will be open, or the pool bar at the Poly. And if there's fireworks at the Magic Kingdom, this sets you up for that. Plus, the Poly is super cool at night with the background music and the fire and the lamps and everything. It's just a fantastic way to end the day.
I love this. The nicest thing is this is outside of the norm. And if you're doing the boat ride over, the leisurely break between appetizers, more to the point, in the stroll from the Grand Flow over the Poly, you work off a couple of calories. So, no, I love this. This is a great idea.
And for some reason, for me, the walk between the Grand Floridian and the Poly is not as hot as the walk from the Magic Kingdom to the Grand Flow, which again, I also did on Tuesday. Yeah, I mean, there's at least a little bit of shade. So yeah, it's not bad.
Okay.
All right. Actually, we have two more questions, Jim. So this one's from Mark, who says, I've always wondered when you see the wait times listed at Walt Disney World or in touring plans, when does the ride start? For example, Tower of Terror. Does your wait end when you're in the elevator, or does your wait end when you're in the library? Same thing for Rise of the Resistance. Does your wait end when you get in the vehicle or when Rey starts talking? So I wrote in my show notes that this reminds me of the conversation that Laurel and I had about whether photography of nature is art. Like what is art? And I said it wasn't. Then Laurel took the other side. So really, yeah. So the for me, the question about when the wait ends and the ride begins depends on the ride and how much line is left after the initial pre-show. So for example, Haunted Mansion, which is, we all know, right? I would argue that the ride begins in the stretching room because the line is minimal after that. And that's an integral part of the overall experience.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Conversely, when you talk about Tower of Terror, I think you are correct that the attraction really begins at the elevator. Cause frankly, once you're in the library and then you get in the basement space, right.
The boilers. Yeah.
Yeah. That depending on when you're in there, that can be a fairly lengthy time.
Yeah. That can be 10 or 15 minutes right there.
Yeah.
So I don't think in Tower of Terror, I don't think it's the library. The library is, it's more of a holding area. And you could argue that over at Enchanted Tales with Belle, when you're first in Maurice's cottage, that is basically just an elaborate queue with effects. The same thing with the second room that you go through. Like that's just more waiting. And I don't know that I would say that attraction begins then, because they're just basically staging you through different areas, but they're entertaining you as you do it. I would say for things like Enchanted Tales with Belle, it actually begins with the story itself in the room.
Yeah.
Rise of the Resistance, I think we would all agree, it begins when Rey starts talking. Like you could argue, and I would definitely listen to this argument, that the ride actually begins in the when you enter the transport ship. Like I could see that as well. For me, there's so little time difference between the two. Like there's not another line you have to get into, that it's just easier to include Rey and just make it clear for people.
I think I can get behind that. So, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, this would be an interesting crossfire on CNN. There
we are. Len, you ignorant slut.
Exactly. That's it as well. All right, here's a question from Eddie in Delaware. Yeah, he says, I have some different types of questions that you might not normally get. I'm unsure if you can or want to answer them, but I'd love to hear what you have to say. Jim, this is you and me. Number one, do you still or have you ever, someone McCarthy, do you still or have you ever loved Disney World and how it's run? I'm not sure if this is a case of Saturday Night Live was better in my day, speaking of Saturday Night Live, or to get in the ins and outs of that, but how do you and Jim feel about how the company is run? So Jim, what's your golden age of Walt Disney World?
Ooh.
Well, first of all, do you love Walt Disney World, right? Or have you ever loved?
I am fond of Walt Disney World. I have enjoyed my many times there. I got married there. I mean, yeah. I have a lot of happy memories associated with Walt Disney World. But if we're talking golden age, I would put that.
So you can ignore the Walt era of theme parks, right? So you has to be after 67.
No, that's it exactly. I would argue that it was, say, from 1988 to 1992.
Wow. 48 months.
This is during that time. Michael Eisner has been on the job for 4 years at this point. Yeah. He has done some investing in theme parks. He's seen the reaction of, opening new hotels and that sort of thing. And it's during this period of time where we get things like the Caribbean Beach Resort, we get the Grand Flow, we also get Disney MGM, and it ends with the Walt Disney World version of Splash Mountain, which I know you don't think belongs there, but that's arguably a better version of the attraction than the one that was built in California.
I think it absolutely belongs in Fertillion. I'm concerned about theming when it becomes Tiana's ride. And not, I mean, Tiana deserves a ride, but from a chronological perspective, we talked about that, yeah. So what was it, 88 to 92?
But again, by the fall of 1992, Michael Eisner is getting the reports out of France about how much they overspent on Euro Disney, and he is not just tapping the brakes, he's putting the brakes all the way down to the floor in regard to future expansions at the parks and that sort of thing. And Michael was a theme park enthusiast from 88 to 92, and we got some amazing things. And then after that, we got the guy who was like, how much have I got left in my wallet? So what about you?
Your era is definitely in the middle of my era. I was actually said 1978 to 2006. And it ends with the golden age ends with the opening of Expedition Everest. So if you want to put a super fine point on it, that's it. Mm-hmm. So different eras of the company. So the Card Walker management team and then Eisner, they had big ideas. So I mean, Card Walker built Epcot. Eisner built two parks himself. They took big risks, right? They built things that they weren't sure that other people wanted. They didn't necessarily look at spreadsheets when making decisions. And they build things. Let's face it, the Disney company would not build Epcot today. The Epcot that was built in 1982, there is absolutely no way on earth this management team would ever approve Epcot. It just wouldn't happen. So for me, it's that time period, 78 to 2006, is when they bet big on Walt Disney World. And not everything worked, right?
No.
But you got to give Eisner credit, right? He is a man not without his faults, right? Mm-hmm. But if you think about all the rides that he built, all the hotels, the parks he built just in Walt Disney World, right? That takes a ton of nerve and a ton of reinvesting money instead of putting it somewhere else in the Disney organization. And so he built.
He did.
Yeah. He did not manage by spreadsheet. And I give him credit for that. So the second part of Eddie's question is this. It's no secret that you guys aren't loved by Disney for your past criticisms. But as a loyal listener, it seems like you're getting increasingly upset about some of these decisions. Yeah, so I'll start here. So I don't think that's true that we're not loved by Disney. I think, and I'm being perfectly honest here, I have literally never met a frontline CM, a cast member, who has told me, you know what, you got this company all wrong. Mm. Like, it's only upper management and the public relations people that are uncomfortable with what I say. And even then, like the PR people, they don't dislike us because we're jerks, right? So when I say things like, be our guest satisfaction ratings started tanking literally the day they introduced the fixed price dinners, right? They know that's true. They have the same data that we have, right? They know what we know. But the problem is it's their job to sell the resort and to sell the Disney mystique. And some of the stuff that we say makes that job harder. So we're not doing them any favors. And then conversely, they don't do us any favors, right? I will say that it hasn't always been that way. There was a time not too long ago where Disney's PR department thought they had a professional obligation to journalists, regardless of what they were going to write. And that changed sometime in the first decade of the 2000s.
Yeah.
I'm not going to mention anybody's names, either good or bad, right? I have some favorites.
I agree. But at the same time, you have to understand that during that same window of time, Disney learned there were different ways to get information out, like the Disney moms.
All right, so to continue, you guys will often say phrases along the lines of, based on other stuff we've heard behind the scenes that we can't talk about in the show and so on, and then drop some information about, marathon dates or ride closures, or even the fact that you send your own people into the park to check wait times and discover the difference between what Disney tells you and the truth. Have you ever heard of Disney executives who listen to your show and begin screaming expletives in their office at the information you provide? All right. So let me just start. Jimmy, you've said this before. There are definitely stories that we will not be able to tell until the right people are retired and in some cases dead, right? Yeah. There's stuff that we know will never happen. Stuff that we know that is probably dead. The projects are dead and will never happen. Mm-hmm. Just telling the story will identify who told it, right? There's just no way to separate the story from the person. And there's stuff that we get on a fairly regular basis about things that are going to happen months or years from now that we can't even reference on the show. And when those things happen, Jim and I are going to act just as surprised as everyone else just to protect our sources, right? Just we have to play a lot. It's part of the game, right?
Yeah.
It's just the nature of doing it, right?
The fact that, you've built up a certain level of trust with sources and that sort of thing. That I've said this before, no story, no matter how, spectacular, is worth destroying somebody's career over.
Yeah, it's just not gonna happen.
They have house payments, they have kids to send to college, and it's just sort of like, okay, so I got to sit on that one for a decade or two, or never tell it.
I tell Laurel all the time, whenever you get one of these stories, it's like, you or I, Jim, whichever one passes first, is going to have the best wake ever because I will start telling the stories. I'll give it to you. And I know you'll listen to me. We should sell tickets to Jim's wake. I think we should.
There we go.
Nancy would want us to. Yeah, yeah.
This just reminds me, there's a famous story about when L.B. Mayer died and all of Hollywood turned out and someone is standing Ned Red Skelton on the steps of the church. And, you know, somebody says, wow, look at the turnout. And Red says, well, you give the public what they want.
That's fantastic. All right. But to answer the second part, have you heard of Disney executives that listen to the show and begin screaming at the information you provide? So this is definitely true. I know that inside certain departments, there was at one time, and there may still be, a kind of McCarthy-esque suspicion of, is this person talking to Jim or what? Like I've heard from people who have been accused of that. And it's taken seriously as a serious problem in some departments. The interesting thing for me is like half the stuff that we talk about, you can figure out just by looking at public documents or, you know, reading patents or looking at source code or whatever. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're getting a little more credit than we're due there, but, yeah, it's definitely a thing. And it may still be a thing in some departments.
I will share a quick story here about how information got tighter coming out of Imagineering.
Yeah.
When Disney acquired Pixar in 2006, because at one point information leaked out about a project that really upset Steve Jobs. And he sat down with Marty Sklar and the rest of the group there and is like, you need to find out who's leaking out of Imagineering. And I will tell you how to do this. And it's like, okay.
Oh, the canary traps.
Well, yeah, you know, yeah. Just the effect of you sit down with the four and five different people who you suspect may be leaking, and you have scripted what you're going to say to them. And there are key phrases and that sort of thing in what you're sharing with this person. And then you just sit back to see what leaks. And it's like if somebody mentions yellow or blue or a train or that sort of thing. Okay.
Yeah. And these are called canary traps in the industry. So you give slightly different pieces of information to everyone and you see what leaks and then you can identify it. So you might not be able to identify the exact person with one leak, but with two leaks, you generally can.
No, that's it exactly. And starting in the late 2000s, information did get tighter, though, again, in the classic way. Once people left the company, you got some wonderful stories. So. Yeah.
I will say that one of the things that I know Disney executives were super upset about, at least at one time, was when Touring Plans started publishing actual and posted wait times. Like there was definitely a faction inside the company who really, really didn't like that and then were looking for ways to stop it. And then there was another group of people who were absolutely fine with it and they wanted to do it themselves. Like, why can't we publish our own wait times? And it looks like the secrecy group has won out for now. And the thing that surprises me about that is like Disney has this, and I'm, this is not news to Jim, but Disney has this, like, it's part of their culture to be suspicious of outsiders. Like, don't collaborate, don't cooperate. And that's the thing that is going to, one of the things that's going to bite them in the butt in the long run. And so here's an example, right? So we make all of our wait time data publicly available to anyone who wants it. Also the metadata around it, right? So if you want to study Disney wait times or restaurant surveys or, you know, any of the data we have, it's publicly available. Go download it. Do what you want with it. And if you go into like GitHub and search for Touring Plans, you will see people who have used the projects who they didn't ask us for it. We didn't give it to them, right? They just publicly got it, right? But the thing is now, since we make the data publicly available, there are tons and tons of high school kids and college kids and professionals who are, you know, learning stuff about data analysis who are using that data and who we have helped. So I've actually lost count of how many times Touring Plans has been referenced in research papers. And every year, and I'm not exaggerating, we help dozens of kids with either their undergraduate capstone projects or grad school research. And they want to understand how Disney works and Disney won't tell them, but we will. So we get the chance, right, at Touring Plans to inspire and to teach part of the next generation of, you know, very smart people how to look at Disney from an analytical, critical perspective. And those kids will eventually teach other kids. And that's how you change attitudes in the long run. And Disney, by not participating in this, is losing out on a huge opportunity to influence those kids, right?
But again, if you're only looking 5 minutes ahead.
Yeah. If you have it's a cultural thing, right? Anyway, so the last question has absolutely nothing to do with Disney. But Eddie says, I'm taking the family out west to see the five big national parks in southern Utah. next April. Arches, Canyonlands, Capitol Reef, Bryce, and Zion. It's not Disney related, but do you have any tips? Kids are 7 and 8. So my first thing is lots and lots of water, Eddie, and long sleeve shirts and sunscreen, and at least enough food and gear to get you through one uncomfortable night if worst comes to worst. I've been in the Colorado desert in Southern California in summer. Jim, you and I were actually there, 121 degrees.
We were. And Walla was on fire, too.
I know. Did you see that Palm Springs is bringing back the Marilyn Monroe statue?
I did. Yeah. I did. We should definitely get a before and after. I'm definitely grayer.
All right. So I've been in Palm Springs where it's 120 degrees. I've also been in Moab, Utah in the summer, and Moab is way worse. I don't know if it's closer to God or whatever. And also, don't forget, when you're hiking, you will probably be at altitude. So I don't know where you're coming from, Eddie, but I think these places start at like 5,500 feet and go from there. In Zion, the Narrows, if the kids can make it, is just about perfect. Like, it's everything you want in a photo of national parks. You can actually, I think, camp there overnight, which, again, if you can get in there with gear, makes the hike easier. In Canyonlands, I think Grandview Point Trail is where it's at. Do that in the morning where the sunlight is great. For Bryce and Arches, and these are the only other ones that I haven't been to, it's not so much the stuff you see during the day, but you can go stargazing at night because you're so far away from light sources.
Yeah.
So you can see the spiral galaxies. You can see the dust clouds. It makes you feel super tiny, and I got vertigo, but it's super cool. And you will not look at the night sky the same way. Also, if you're going to do anything in Bryce, stick to the Rim Trail. Everything else is super crowded. I haven't been to Capitol Reef, but let me know how it is.
I know Sequoia wasn't mentioned in the pile here, but Len, at some point in the not-so-distant future, you and I have to get out to that part of California sometime between May to September, when the access road to Mineral King is open.
Oh, I would totally do that.
Nancy and I have been the once, and they say it's a two-lane road. It's not a two-lane road. But, you know, the effective sign that says, yeah, beware of marmots who will crawl up into your car engine and eat through the hoses that provide coolant for your car.
I mean, beware of marmots is just good advice in general.
It's no bear on the front porch, which I'll tell you about later. But, you know, yeah, the marmots inside the engine of your car are a bad thing.
Huh, so. Marmots, how about that? All right, folks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, Jim tells us the story of Toy Story Midway Mania at the Disney theme parks. We'll be right back.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
So with the opening of Adventures Campus last week and the opening of the new Web Slingers ride, we thought it would be a good idea to sort of review Disney's history of building these kinds of rides, right? And you thought, well, there's no better place to start than with Toy Story Midway Mania.
If you're really telling the story of the development of Toy Story Midway Mania, we actually have to take a step back to the opening. In fact, it was 23 years ago this week when the very first Disney Quest opened on the west side of Downtown Disney in Orlando.
Okay.
I'm assuming our listeners, a bunch of them at least, got into that Disney Quest, which was an indoor interactive theme park, five stories tall, 100,000 1,000 square feet of space inside.
The ultimate video arcade.
Disney, when they were developing these, and this was Disney's regional entertainment division.
Yep.
At one point, there was a very ambitious plan for these indoor theme parks. At one point, Disney planned on building 30 of these worldwide.
Wow.
It wasn't just that it was an arcade. They embraced the arcade aesthetic, as in people, when they come back, are going to expect new things. So we have not only have quality attractions for opening day, and there were things like the virtual jungle cruise. It was an inflatable raft on a motion base, and you had a real paddle, and you were supposedly, you had traveled back in time with Wayne Szalinski from the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids movies, and you had to chase down the time gizmo to get back home. There was likewise Cyberspace Mountain, where you... the two-person compartment where you designed your own coaster, and the Aladdin's Magic Carpet ride with the where you sat on the motion base with the head-mounted display and then supposedly flew through the streets of Agrabah.
Yep. That was the first one, right? That was the first one that I remember, yeah.
The first of these attractions opens in June of 1998. So, we figure we're going to get guests coming through this on a regular basis, so we need to prep our next major attraction. And so they take Hercules in the Underworld, which was an opening day attraction. And after just 2 years in being in the Orlando building, they pull it out. And they then put in an attraction known as Pirates of the Caribbean Battle for Buccaneer Gold. Do you remember this, Len? Okay.
This is the dueling ships.
It was. But at the same time, it was for the time, but for the year 2000, amazingly cutting edge. It's a 5-minute long experience. You walk into a room where you are surrounded by this 270-degree screen. It fills your field of vision, but there are now 5 stations in the room. There are 4 cannons that have a pulse ring mechanism, and then in the centermost position, there's a ship's wheel. Yep. And so the 5, you and 4 of your friends step into the room, and you decide who's going to be the captain of the ship and who's going to man the gun turrets. And then the screen footage starts running on these 270-degree screens, and you are on a pirate ship in the harbor sailing out to do battle with pirate ships. And if you were pulling on that pull string and firing on the ship, on your screen, it would not only take damage, but if you concentrated your fire on the ship's armory, it would burst into flames.
I remember this. And you get this sort of the 1960s fake flame effect on the...
That's it, exactly.
Yeah,
you'd feel the heat, and you'd get a whiff of smoke, and this would continue right up until you got to sort of the last 2 minutes or so, and then you would face down the attraction's big bad, which was Jolly Roger and his cursed skeleton pirates. The problem here is that by the time this attraction opens at Disney Quest, Disney has lost confidence in its indoor theme park idea.
I know. That's so sad.
They built one more Disney Quest. It was opened in Chicago in June of 1999. So 1 year after the Downtown Disney version. And it closed on September 4th, 2001. That's a week before 9/11.
Yeah, so it wasn't even related to terrorism. Wow.
No. The problem was that it would do killer business during the weekend and would be empty on weekdays. And it was a business plan that just couldn't sustain itself.
So how does Dave and Buster stay in business and Disney Quest doesn't?
If you talk with the folks who worked on Disney Quest, their argument was you put the restaurant on the bottom floor.
Oh, instead of the top floor.
Top floor.
You think that's it? That it's basically you want the restaurant and bar as easily accessible as possible?
That's it, exactly. To hear the Dave and Buster people talk, it's so much easier to sell people game tokens after they've had a couple of drinks. I've had a great meal. I've enjoyed myself. Let's go play for a couple hours. And they had a wonderful restaurant up on the 5th floor that had food that the Cheesecake Factory consulted on. It was wonderful stuff, but you had to have already purchased admission to Disney Quest to then just get access to the 5th floor of the building where the restaurant was located. By 2000, they're walking away from this concept. In fact, I'm sure you've heard the stories about the Philadelphia version of Disney Quest where, they went so far as to dig the cellar hole for this 5-story building.
No.
And then Disney walked away. And then for years.
Do you know what's buried in that hole in Philadelphia, Jim? what's not buried in
the wall. I love the stories about people who, you know, are giving directions in the city. It's like, okay, so you go to, you know, that street and make a turn at the Disney Hole. Disney Womp basically walks away from Disney Quest in 2000. But here's the thing. The Orlando version stays open for another 15 years.
Hey, we got a dead horse over here. Here's your stick.
I was thinking, how many times have you talked about the Disney formula for we built this attraction, we have so many years built into the plan, we have to recover our costs.
Yeah, 20 or 30 years, depending on the depreciation, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, the fact that, you know, they kept this in place for 15, 16 years, and when you talked with folks in Orlando, it's like, we have enough rainy days here that people get chased out of the park and they're looking for something to do and they'll end up at Disney Quest. And we'll happily take that business, but we won't put dime one into putting new attractions into this building. What we have in the building is perfectly fine for a concept that we've abandoned. So now we talk about Disney walks away from this concept in 2001. That's also a problematic year for the company, because remember, that's also the year that California Adventures opens in February and almost immediately underwhelms theme park guests. Yeah. And then 8 months later, as you mentioned, 9/11 happens. And for 6 months or so, theme park attendance around the world dips because no one's traveling. In California, they feel like we need to do something immediately to get people to come back, or at least to sample this park. And Disney's own guest survey said that there isn't a lot to this park that's kid-friendly. So that's one of the reasons why you saw a Bugs Land fast-tracked. I mean, that land with Flicks Funfair opened in October of 2002. I mean, the place hadn't even been open, 15 months at this point? And it's like, new land, we need a new land. Then you look around the rest of the park, and it's like, with the exception of like King Triton's Carousel by the Sea, where are the Disney characters? I mean, you've got the Disney Animation building, but beyond that, this is kind of a character-free park. At the same time, again, you've got a Walt Disney Company that, much like today, after the pandemic, is kind of watching its wallet for a while. And here's that 6 months after 9/11. And they're looking cold-bloodedly at California Adventure. And it's like, look, you know, we spent $1.1 billion on the expansion of Disneyland Resort. And it's like, what's working? And it's like, well, Grand California Resort and Spa, working great. Disneyland Esplanade is a, you know, a way to get people back and forth across the park, also good. Downtown Disney Shopping and Dining District, very happy there. I mean, we have to change out, you know, a store here, a restaurant there, but that's standard for kind of a mall thing.
Yeah.
And Mickey and Friends parking structure with its, you know, room for 10,000 cars, you know, this is all great. The one part that isn't working is California Adventure.
All the stuff around the theme park, fabulous. Yeah. The actual theme park itself,
yeah. So because of that $1.1 billion, the Imagineers know, with Disney holding the purse strings, especially tied to this moment, it's like, look, you have to find an affordable way to fix this park. This park needs more attractions featuring characters, but we don't want to spend a lot of money developing something new. We want you guys to think around corners, to find things that we've done previously. And so,
look, I know it takes $1 billion to build a theme park, right? But we've already spent that $1 billion.
That's right. So here we have Pirates of the Caribbean, the Battle for Buccaneers Gold. And in the year 2000, THEA, the Themed Entertainment Association, actually, you know, recognized that attraction for excellence because, you know, it's innovative. I mean, the fact that you're on a motion base and, you know, with that smoke and water effects and that sort of thing, it's like, you know, this is a killer ride experience.
And it didn't cost $100 million to build.
No, it did not. Yeah. So you're now an Imagineer and you're in that kind of chocolate and peanut butter space. You have to take things you've already got and combine them in ways that allow you to do something affordable.
Yeah, we need to build a new ride. It has to be great. We've got the budget of a used Honda Accord.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the Imagineers start, you know, their pitch with like, let's look at Paradise Pier. We only got that one character base ride. We've got King Triton's Carousel by the Sea. This is supposed to be the part of the park that honors the seaside amusement parks of California. Mm-hmm. It said, Seaside amusement parks always had shooting galleries.
All right.
And so we have this mechanism from Pirates of the Caribbean, Battle for Buccaneers Gold. And it's like, what if we do a ride-through shooting gallery? And the folks at the Disneyland Resort, it's like, wonderful idea, killer. Sounds kind of familiar. Sort of like that Buzz Lightyear Astro Blaster ride we're building over at Disneyland right now. The one that's supposed to open in 2005 as part of the park's 50th anniversary.
Or similar to Buzz Lightyear, which has been in World since 98.
Yeah. But get to the adventures. No. Buzz uses ray guns with triggers. You know, ours is completely different. You know, this is a cannon with a pull string. You know, it's a boop, 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 boop. So, you know, that's an entirely different experience. And we're going to build our ride around the company's biggest star. And that is Mickey Mouse.
Okay, well, we know that didn't happen.
Well, and that's what we'll get to on our next show, where we discuss how we went from Mickey's Midway Madness to Toy Story Mania.
So here's my, this is the thing I've always wanted to know about Toy Story Mania. You know, you mentioned the pull string mechanism.
Yep.
How strong is that rope that's attached to it? Because you think about how many, I'm pretty enthusiastic when I'm pulling that rope, right? When I'm playing this thing. And I got you don't ever see them break. You don't even see them frayed. I'm like, could this thing moor the Queen Elizabeth, the QE2? if we ran into a problem, like, wow, what is this? Is there steel reinforcement? Like, is it like a steel belted radial tire? But
I can tell you from conversations I've had with Imagineers, they love hearing you say this, Len. They're the people who spent weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks testing particular.
Oh no! Like, I think about it every time I ride. I'm like, why have I never seen one of these things break? They don't fray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's
but
amazing.
Conversely, the fact that if we talk about Wetslinger's a Spider-Man adventure, the fact that there is no pulse ring mechanism, right, and this all keys off of facial recognition and recognizing how your hand is moving, because frankly, there is a cost to those ropes and maintaining them.
And it's more, that's a more natural fluid movement to do it that way. I'm waiting for someone to throw out a shoulder.
It's already happened.
Or
carpal tunnel. Exactly. You know, just sort of like,
oh so. Yeah, like when you come off of Toy Story, if you don't have like an ache in a shoulder or some sort of repetitive stress injury, you didn't play hard enough to win. Like, that's on you.
There you go.
All right, great interesting story, Jim. That's really fun.
Mm. Okay, cool.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for the Disney Dish show today. Please head on over to disneydish.bandcamp.com, where you'll find exclusive shows never before on iTunes, including a new show on the history of World of Color at Disney's California Adventure. On next week's show, we're going to continue this story of the history of Toy Story Mania. You can find more of Jim at jimhillmedia.com and more of me, Len, at touringplans.com. We're produced fabulously by Aaron Adams, who will be sharing Grandpa Adams' secret recipe for strawberry icebox pie and Grandma Adams' double secret recipe for strawberry ripple at the 49th Annual Monroe Congregational Church Strawberry Festival this coming weekend, June 19th and 20th, at the Monroe Congregational Church in beautiful downtown Monroe, Connecticut. While Aaron's doing that, please go into iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We'll see you on the next show.